Assalamu alaikum everyone, and welcome to another episode of Great People TV with me, Ben Ibrahim, and our wonderful international co-host, Sylvia Friedman. Sylvia, how are you? What's going on in your part of the world?
Oh, it's great. I mean, despite the pandemic, we're hanging in there, trying to stay happy and active. So I'm happy to talk with you, and our next guest, Nabil, is here.
That's right. Now, just backtrack a little bit. Our topic today is about climate change, very prevalent to especially our Asian Malaysian audience, because, yeah. I mean, not too long back, a lot of us here in Malaysia experienced the disasters of the floods, and you know, our thoughts are with many of the families who had to experience that. And please, everyone, stay extra safe, because you never know, the weather is changing. And that's why we brought on Nabil Ishmair to talk about climate change, a bona fide professional to talk about this topic. Sylvia, please introduce our guests and please tell our audience about this wonderful, amazing individual.
Yes, Nabil, he is an eco warrior. He's a brilliant engineer. He builds solar power plants during the day. And at night, he writes articles that have been published in major publications. And he's written a book that came out, published by Penguin Random House Southeast Asia. It's a cli-fi novel, not a sci-fi. It's a climate-focused novel. And it was birthed out of the questions he asks. You know, what if climate change was reversed? Would it improve inequality in the world? And so he'll talk with us about his passion for renewable energy, and he'll give us some tips. I'm really excited because he's a really deep thinker about climate change, and it's a topic I really need to be thinking and acting more on, Ben. I'm guilty of not always doing my part.
Likewise. Well, without further ado, let's welcome Nabil on Great People TV. Nabil, how are you? You safe and well?
Hey, yeah. I mean, like Sylvia said, it's difficult to stay safe and well when the world is going through a pandemic.
True.
But yeah, all things considered, my brother had COVID just 2 weeks ago, so they went through that whole thing. But thank God we are vaccinated. So for everyone out there, get vaccinated. It really helps you through the process, because they just had sort of minor symptoms. I've heard people without vaccinations, they get, you know, the full kind of COVID symptoms, and it's important to get vaccinated.
All right. Now, Sylvia gave you a fabulous introduction right there before, but let's start. I'll just start with the first question and then pass it over to yourself and then Sylvia. And please, Sylvia, lead the way, because your contacts are, Nabil is your contact, an amazing contact, amazing CV. But Nabil, what led to your passion about climate change? I mean, because it is really, not individuals like you do not grow on trees. No, pun intended.
Growing trees is a good thing, I think. Yeah. So I kind of like shy away from the term eco warrior. I think I'm just sort of a regular guy. There are a lot of us out there who are regular guys who want to do something, and sometimes it's difficult to find an avenue to doing something. So climate change sort of was first introduced to me through Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. So before that, I wasn't very aware of what was happening, but he kind of put it in a fashion where we saw the real risks, flooding, heat waves, forest fires, all of that was sort of put in very plain words for someone like me to understand. And I need things to be explained very well. You know, that's why I call myself a regular guy. So that was one of the reasons why I started to look at it more. And then during 2011-ish, 2010, 2011, when the Syrian war started, one of the things, so there are these little stories that sort of got me even more into climate. So like the Syrian story was, one of the things they were asking for was freedom, dignity, and bread. And bread is something that you don't hear that often. And there were these shortages happening in Syria. And it turns out that there were droughts in Russia that same time that were climate linked, which led to bread shortages, which led to the this sort of instable conflict. You know, like I don't know, like Malaysians as well, but Arabs, I think more, they can tolerate a lot of bad government. they've been doing this for like 40, 50 years. We can tolerate it, right? But it's hard to see your child go hungry. I think that's, and that's where you start to draw a line. Right?
100%.
You start to say, that's it, yeah. So then you saw, so I actually met some of these individuals from Syria because I did a solar power project in Saudi Arabia. And these were guys like French teachers and, like supermarket people, people who worked in different kinds of things. And now they're just doing solar because they don't have a choice, right? And I asked him, like, why exactly, what do you think of the conflict? Like, do you support the rebels? Do you support do you support Assad? And they just told me they don't care. Realistically, they don't care. What has happened is they've just lost their livelihoods to this and to this conflict. And therefore, now they're forced to leave their country and everything behind. And that those kind of stories sort of stayed with me. And that connection back to climate change sort of drove me more and more into what I do today.
Nice. Sylvia?
Nice. Yes, tell us about your critically acclaimed cli-fi novel, The Hunter's Walk. And you tackle the themes of climate change as well as inequality. So unpack it for us, and then I'll go back to Al Gore's documentary, The Inconvenient Truth, because that seems to be the turning point for so many. It really impacted a generation, didn't it? And cli-fi novels are really hot right now. So explain what your novel is, and even explain what cli-fi is for our viewers who may not have heard about that.
Sure. So the novel came about. So I'm not like a writer by aspiration. I like to write articles and stuff like that. But what happened was in about 2009 when Barack Obama was elected, and then also in Sri Lanka, the Sri Lankan conflict, the civil war that we had for 30 years, that was ramping down. The question of race was something that I was thinking about, and then I suddenly started to think about skin color itself. Why is skin color such a divisive thing, right? But why do we have different skin color in the first place? And it turns out that about 50,000 years ago, our African ancestors migrated out of Africa and went northwards where there was less ultraviolet light. And their skin adapted to survive out there. And that's the reason. It's not because we had to have different skin colors as part of the survival thing. We needed to lighten our skin so that we could live up in the northern cycle. So that was something that happened during the sort of the last ice age. So these things started to connect. So now you have these people going up from Africa, darker skin, maybe meeting lighter skin people up in the north. And during the last ice age, what if the last ice age was actually a time of a lot of changing climate as well, because you had these huge temperature changes. So like we are talking about a temperature change of 2 degrees. There were degree changes of like 8 and 5 and 10 degrees in the ice age. So what if you had this changing climate with these new introduction of different skin color happening at the same time? Would our dark skin ancestors have met more fair skin ancestors? Would there have been conflict at that time? And that was how the book was sort of born. So it has themes of cli-fi. It has the main theme that goes through it is colorism. So how skin color can be discriminated against. And then in those societies, I've sort of built it up as, I think when we think about prehistoric people, we tend to think of them as sort of tribal and maybe a little just walking around bopping each other on the head, right? So sort of caveman sort of thing. But the new science to that actually shows that they were very artistic. You have the Lascaux caves, you have the art coming from 30, 40,000. So these were us. These were people like us, actually. They just didn't have maybe the same tools that we have. But you would have had a Leonardo da Vinci from that time, who was a forward thinker, who could think about things in art. And so that my protag is one of those characters. And he tries to lead them out of this this sort of discrimination context into a more diverse, inclusive world. And that's The Hunter's Walk. Cli-fi is actually a small subset of fiction which talks about it's not centered around climate, but it talks about themes of how climate can actually exacerbate other issues, like worsen other problems. Like a lot of sci-fi will talk about this context of rising temperatures or rising sea levels and how that changes people's lives. So the stories are still centered among us, among human beings, but you have this context of climate change. And the way I incorporated that into the Hunter's Walk was through the Ice Age. There was this huge change in temperatures, droughts, and there's even an introduction to snow in these drought-ridden areas. So how do the people deal with that? And that's one of the things that I want to sort of answer. So we know how climate will affect the world in terms of rising sea levels and increasing temperatures. What I wanted to look at was how climate change would affect us. Would we be open to populist theories like racism or discrimination? Would women have to go back to, would their rights be taken away, and they would have to focus on childbearing, etc.? Because climate creates all of these kind of instabilities in our societies, and all those rights that our ancestors have fought for us, will that disappear suddenly because of this unstable? Yeah.
No, these are ingenious, out of the box questions. Very deep. You're such a deep, unusually deep thinker. Your novel, The Hunter's Walk, was stunningly written. I'm almost finished, and it really is, a must read. What are the key takeaways that you want people to get, especially in regards to climate change? Like, do you want them to take action? I mean, this is an activist novel, is it not? Like, what do you want readers to, you know, walk away with?
I think, especially from a cli-fi novel, I just want them to ask. I mean, it would be great. I think for me, there are two things to make a good book. One is it entertains you. And then the other one is it informs you. So on the informing part, I would like people to ask the question beyond what the science tells us, what about rising sea levels, about temperatures. I would ask, does it affect us? Does it really affect us? What can it actually do to us? Like our communities, if we lose our homeland to flooding, what does that mean? Does that mean that we will have to go somewhere as refugees? Would the new territory actually accept us as refugees? Would we be treated as the Syrians are being treated in Europe, for example? You know, that image of that little boy who died on the shores, Island Kurdi, right? So that's the image that's in my head from the refugee issue. Climate change can, so if we let it go to 2 degrees, there are stats and forecasts that say the refugee crisis will increase to about 200 million. And right now we're dealing with about 5 million. Yeah, so in Syria, and then you have the Ukrainians and stuff like that. But 200 million people is just insane. And I don't know how we will.
It is. And Nabil, closer to home, can you unpack and educate us on the flooding in Malaysia? How is that connected to climate change? Climate change is such a huge umbrella term. And I've read that partly it's because the ground, the dirt is so dried up that it can't really absorb the water like it used to, and that's related to the rising temperatures. I mean, but I'm an amateur compared to you.
Same thing.
can you share with us, because the flooding victims in Malaysia are dear and close to my heart. I hope, you know, if there's anyone watching, please give to those who've been affected, because they're still being affected even after the cameras are not shining on them. So Nabil, teach us about how is the flooding with devastated parts of Malaysia, how is that related to the big topic of climate change?
Yeah, so again, as I'm a regular guy as well, I'm not a climate scientist, right? So what I try to do is then read up from what climate scientists are actually telling us. So I think in the Malaysian context, there was a guy called Rene Sia, So René Theau, so he is actually working for the the World Bank, and he's their climate advisor. And he explained it like this. If the Earth's temperature increases, then that increases the atmosphere's ability to hold moisture. And the atmosphere doesn't just take the water and then throw it. It has an ability to hold it. And the more it holds, the more chance it has to just suddenly let it go in something like the floods that we saw. So you have these 100-year floods, which are also related to like a 100-year rainfall. So this is supposed, so technically these 100-year rainfalls are supposed to happen once in 100 years. But unfortunately, we've seen them twice in the last 2 years. So we had, I think, 2021 and recently, 2021, 22. 5 people died the year before, but 50 people died this year. So you're seeing this sort of increase in the occurrence of these events. And the science is pretty clear on how it happens. It's just more reason for us to act. Malaysia is actually a country which has ability to do a lot of renewable energy as well. So that's something that we've seen, especially the large-scale solar tenders in Malaysia. So that's a fantastic development, and I hope that just keeps going. And you know, it could become a place where you're actually selling electricity to Singapore, for example. So that it's not just for your own consumption, but it becomes an economic advantage as well. So that's something maybe we can talk about as well later on.
Yeah,
but as part of the business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Go ahead, Ben.
Nabil, I only have two major questions here because I like listening more than talking. My ears are bigger than my eyes, so I use that to my advantage. So maybe like you could tell us, I mean, I know you've said you're not an expert and everything, but you know, you've got really, really great insight into what really goes on, what we read in newspapers and on the blogs, and what's actually actual truth. So I was doing research to this topic, I mean, I know a little bit about climate change, generic stuff, but you know, not deep, deep stuff. So what are two questions I want to ask you? The first question is, what are the attitudes of global leaders, CEOs, presidents, politicians in general about climate change? And the second part of that question is, you know, like, if certain things are not addressed, will all the Hollywood movies come true the day after tomorrow? You know, and all, as an example, and all of the
great above. Question.
Yeah. So because this is an alarming, and I know I'm going to annoy a lot of people by saying this, but this is an alarming quote when Donald Trump said, he said, climate change is like the weather. So you shouldn't be bothered. I mean, that really annoys me because with attitudes like that, the day after tomorrow will come.
Yeah. So I get annoyed by that as well, especially when, you know, you have these congressmen bring a snowball into Congress and say, hey, hang on, where's global warming? This is snow. It's just outside the Congress.
Tell me about
it. It weirdly enough, in the 90s, you had even conservatives. So right now, most of the pushback in terms of governance is coming from the conservative side. Conservatives are people who are more business oriented. They tend to be a little more right wing ideology. So these guys are a little, they used to be actually active on climate as well. So in the 90s, you could actually see them, people like George Bush, etc., you know, who have ignorant views on everything else, but somehow they were actually quite active on climate. But I think during the 2000s, there was this great big push from, kind of like the oil lobby. These things are always hard to prove because these are done sort of like through the lobbies and through sort of...
The usual conventional routes.
Yeah, it's not a direct line, right?
No, so, it's not. Yeah.
So you have the heritage group and, you know, all of these kind of right-wing conservative movements. And they sort of focused on changing the conversation on climate change. But the first thing that they said was, is climate change real? So that went on for about 10 years. Then they said, okay, fine, it is real, but is there something we can do about it? And now we're at a stage where they're saying, yes, it's real. We must do something about it, but it's going to cost a lot of money. So where's the money going to come? So I think, thankfully, leaders have progressed to a point where it's still too slow to change, but at least, you know, the mindset has changed to climate change is real and we have to do something about it. But now the question is, how do we try and finance it? The good thing that has happened while these guys are sort of delaying is things like renewables have really dropped in price. So wind power and solar power are the cheapest electricity you can have. So even in Malaysia, where you produce natural gas electricity, that costs around 4 to 5 cents. The recent LSS-4 and LSS-3 projects produce electricity at cheaper than that. So somewhere in about the same range, but slightly cheaper. So this price is going down further. And what countries like Malaysia and all should be doing is taking advantage of that. So because you have enough land, and if you use it in the right way, including things like agrivoltaics, etc., then you should be able to actually produce all the electricity that you need. Plus, maybe so. Coming back to your question, from a government's point of view, I think there is positive movement. They're starting to recognize the problem.
Right.
The issue now is there is still sort of the oil lobby and all these fossil fuel interests who are trying to muddy the waters in what we can do. The first thing that we can do is stop using fossil fuels. That's the main. We need to stop that. Go electric. So your transport should be electrified. So that's something that Elon Musk has helped in, you know, at least introduce us to that. But now you have much cheaper models coming in from South Korea and from China, et cetera. So already you have that's actually quite incredible to me. Every car company has a good lineup of electric cars now. I'm actually surprised that I was a bit cynical that this is going to take another 20, 30 years. But they're actually all jumping on board because electric cars are actually better, right? They're faster, they're cleaner. It just boggles my mind. There's this interesting fact, you know, in the 1900s when cars came about, the first cars, there are actually more electric cars than fuel cars, internal combustion. So we started at a place where we had actually more electric cars, but then when Ford came at its assembly line, then those cars became much cheaper. So it was really an unfortunate sort of lemony snicket kind of thing, you know, like where we could have gone electric much sooner, but, you know, it just unfortunate series of events, we ended up moving towards fossil fuels. And yeah, that's that has had other effects, but to your question, I think it's improving, and we are at a stage where we can enforce some changes. So the IPCC still says there are things that we can do, and that's the science part of it. So if we can listen to the scientists, listen to the IPCC, follow what they're telling us to do, then I think we can hopefully keep it down to two degrees Celsius.
My next question, Nabil, is why should people care? You know, is it because, and my late father-in-law used to say this because he was an early climate change scientist and researcher at MIT. And he used to say the world is going to be a fireball in my grandparents' generation. And then before he passed away a few years ago, I asked him again, because he was always concerned about the increasing temperature of the earth. And he seemed to suggest that it was going to happen even before the grandchildren's generation, and they're in their late 30s now. So why should people care about climate change? And what are some tips that what can ordinary people like you and I do to combat it? And so please take it away.
Yeah, so I think we are beginning to see the real effects. Maybe early on in the 2000s, we didn't see the additional hurricanes. We did not see the forest fires. We did not see the flooding that's going on because it was dispersed. And you know, even though there was proof that it was climate change was playing a role in those, it's more prevalent now. So now you can actually like see the kind of disasters that are happening, right? And also the knock-on effects of droughts, for example, in the Arab Spring. You can see those knock-on effects. This is now you're not believing your eyes. If you're still saying that climate is something that you don't have to care about, then you know then this is beyond insanity. Like we're actually seeing the effects, and we know that it's happening, and this is why we should care about it. And that's why I like to try and look at the systems of stability. So you have the climate system, but over that you have our human systems, our economies, our transport system, our education system. Everything sits on a stable climate. There's an interesting like graph that shows temperature over the last 2 million years, and you have the last ice age, and you can see that you know there's some wild fluctuations going on up till about 10,000 years ago, and 10,000 years ago it all stabilizes. It's a bit between 1 degree or something like that. So the reason why I'm finding this out is agriculture and human civilization started around 10,000 years ago. So our whole system of civilization is built on this idea of a stable climate. If we go back to the Ice Age, then you know we won't have the same kind of civilization that we have now. We won't have populations all over the world. We would be concentrated in a few places, maybe like around the equatorial belt. You know, you can't live on an ice sheet that's 2 kilometers thick. So that's why we should sort of think about it. Like, but coming back to, you know, like some of the earlier views, like, you know, the Earth would become a fireball, etc. I think that is relatively, at least from the science point of view, that's relatively down the road, far down the road. Within our lifetimes, if we can keep everything down to 2 degrees, the increase in temperature to 2 degrees by 2050, then what we do is we halve the, so if it increases above 2, we will lose a certain number of species. We will lose, there'll be a certain number of people who live in a very hot, arid climates where they can't survive anymore. And we will lose a certain amount of our harvest in terms of agriculture. We can halve that loss if we keep it down to two degrees by 2050. If we don't, then we will lose the full amount. Wow. Yeah, so that is... So,
and then there's all these food security issues. And exactly. Wow, like, and the sea, like it may not feed and sustain us anymore. But do you have any tips for us, the ordinary person? Because you know so much. And I mean, you've referred to the CO2zilla in your writings before. I mean, Ben and I laughed about that, but please, you're just such a font of knowledge, and it's really fascinating hearing all that you've 100%. Shared.
Yeah, so I think generally when people ask this question, it's really interesting, because this kind of question actually came from the oil lobby, the fossil fuel industry.
Yes.
What can individuals do? And I'm not saying that, you know, you're a part of that, but what I'm saying is that this mindset that we have, that we have to do something, this originally came from the recycling movement. Then the other one was, you know, ride your bicycles movement, you know, those kind of sort of good, small grassroots changes, but it kind of distracts us from the bigger culprits, the CO2zilla, the Godzillas of climate change, right? So... so those guys are still walking around while we're riding a bicycle. You know, that doesn't make sense. We need to be dealing with Godzilla or CO2zilla, and those companies. So what I would structure it as an individual is really first focus on, if you're in a democratic country, vote for pro climate representatives. Like, I think in Malaysia we had a really good environmental minister, Yeobin Yee, right?
Yeobin Yee, yeah. Cambridge, Cambridge graduate, knows all the science and politics behind it, literally.
Yeah, so that's exactly what, you know, I think female leaders have really, you know, taken a step up. We have like Angela Merkel, we have Jacinda Ardern, we have people like Yeobin Yee. So, somehow the women are leading us through this a little better.
Women are smarter.
I don't know. I think they're on more. You know, like the men are still focused on, you know, driving cars and that sort of thing. So
we're focused on convenience.
Probably. So the first thing I would do is vote. Vote for people who are active on climate, because really the changes that we need to do are at a government level, at an institutional level. I would also, if possible, participate in sort of grassroots movements to better educate people, and also participate in you know, like town halls, or talk to your representative. Even if they're not climate pro-climate, then talk to them and say, look, I care about this. I'm your constituent. And try and use that voice that you have. So that's sort of the first thing that I would do. Sort of think about, how do I change institutions? How do I change society? The second thing that I would do, and that, you know, that I've tried to do, is change our workplaces. So a lot of the factories we work at, we can sort of introduce building efficiency. We can change our industrial process to reduce our emissions. We can build solar on our rooftops, things like that, right? And that you have to really engage with the stakeholders within your organization. So those people who have some clout within their companies, go and talk to your boss and say, look, we should be doing this. We're actually saving money if we install solar panels. We're saving money if we make our buildings more efficient. You know, so there's so much reason to be doing this. And then the last thing I would do, it's still important. I would avoid using straws, ride my bicycle a little more. And
hear that? Did you hear that, Ben? So my last question is, tell us about your amazing company. I think it's a startup. It's called Empower Energy. It has no vowels in it. Tell us about it, and how can people participate in your business movement and your important contribution to bringing the power of solar into countries that need it? And it's cheaper than electricity, isn't it?
Fossil fuel electricity, yeah. So it's part of the reason why we started Empower Energy was we wanted to focus on that word, empower. So to try and empower smaller companies to adopt solar, and to try and empower countries who are not really doing solar yet, but to help them develop and come up with more solar. Because my earlier job was actually in managing projects and developing projects across Asia. And I wanted to sort of, generally bigger companies focus on, you know, the big apples, the closer fruit, so the big companies and the big the countries who are already involved. What Empower Energy wants to do is sort of focus on the more niche, so the smaller rooftops, and the countries who are trying to enter the solar market, for example, or the wind market. So that's what we want to do. And as part of that Empower framework, maybe in the future, what we would like to do is also have cooperative solar, where we get more community engagement. Communities own their own solar system, for example. So if you have a neighborhood full of, and you have some land next to that neighborhood, then you build that solar plant in your land, and you own that as a neighborhood, as a collective, and you get the profits from that. You use that electricity, and then you get the energy savings from using that. So it's that's something that we want to try and build as well. So,
yeah. So yeah. That's brilliant.
Renewables are cheaper. So now you have storage coming in. I think it's game over for fossil fuels unless we keep subsidizing them. So let's try and move them away. Yeah.
And your website is can you just quickly give us your website?
So our website is www.mpwrnrgy. So Empower Energy.
Empower.
Yeah, so that's right. I tried to get the word empower. So that's probably where the name is. But it's very hard to get. Well, we live in an age where you have to pick names very selectively.
Well, let me help you out with that, Nabil, in terms of giving a plug and a shout out to the word empower, and I'll say that more in a minute. But before we do that, just want to wrap up this episode and say, sorry, Sylvia, no more questions, right? Or you got more?
No. It's just been fascinating, and there's so much knowledge to process. Yeah. And I mean, I'm trying to use my recycle bag and reduce plastic every day.
Yeah.
And I try not to drive, or do the ride share or whatever. I mean, I'm trying to do my part, but I'm not good. I'm not consistent.
No, I'm
so that is why you need to get governments to do it, because really a lot of this change is at an institutional level. It's not at our level.
Yeah, true.
And okay. a good way to prove that is the pandemic. So the pandemic, we had 5% reduction in carbon emissions. 5%.
Wow.
So that's amazing. Nothing.
Yeah, it helps,
but see, the idea is if we ride our bikes more, if we don't go outside, if we don't go on holidays, then the emissions will drop, right? That's the idea, that the individual can do something. But it did nothing. It's 5% is good, but it's not the problem. We need to solve the problem. So yes. It's at an institutional level that we're
great point.
Well, Nabil, you did a great
these
job.
These are not my points. These are climate activists. Those guys have raised it, and I'm just like helping communicate it. That's
too humble. You're too humble.
Too humble. But Nabil, you did a great. I mean, I know Sylvia is thinking the same thing. You did a great job today explaining in very simple layman's terms about the challenges, the issues, the mindsets, and what more needs to be done. So thank you so much for that. And yeah, we really appreciate your explanation of it. So, and I mean. Sorry to say goodbye, but anytime you do want to come back on Great People TV and say, you know, great stuff about, you know, what you're trying to do and what Empower is trying to do, please go ahead.
Yes.
Because I know it's a cliche saying, be the change, you are the change, but you are literally the change. Yes. And we wish you, and that's the way that Great People TV, like myself and Sylvia, can support you on that journey and notion. So Nabil, thank you so much. And I just want to share this story with everybody before we leave today. I mean, it's really funny that Sylvia asked a brilliant question, what more needs to be done. Nabil, like a great person, explained it great, really, really well, and a great job explaining that. So great people. Like when 20 years ago when I was at school, the science teacher, Mr. Gilbert, said, climate change, you guys got to do your part. He put a video on, and that person said, what are you going to do about climate change? Have a shower with a friend. So we're like, oh, you know, 15, 16-year-old boys, like, what is that? So like, so I'm not going to encourage having a shower with a friend. What we will encourage, we being Great People TV, and on behalf of Nabil, we're going to encourage everybody to empower your friends to put pressure on the decision makers, like Nabil said, so governments can pull up their socks if they're not, or do more, because like Sylvia said, we're all living in a convenience bubble. And if we live in that convenience bubble, you know, the Hollywood movies that we watched over the last 10, 15 years will become a reality, which is, we do not want to live in that. And maybe we will have to have a shower with a friend if that does happen.
So, for other reasons.
Yes. So, Nabil, I'm glad I put a smile on your guys' face. Nabil, anytime you want to be back on the show, hit us up, my man. You'll be back on because you're a great person and great people. Welcome.
Thanks. You guys are very inspiring.
Okay.
Thank you, Nabil. You're so brilliant. Thank you.
Stay safe as best as you can. Okay.
Thanks so much.
Wow. Lot of food for thought to unpack. He's brilliant.
I mean, I'm gonna put some pressure and write some letters today, I think, to climbing. I really don't want to live in that world that the academics are saying we might, if things are not done, Sylvia.
Yes, for your kids and also for Matt's kids and the next generation, we've got to. Please add my name to those letters or emails.
I
need to start doing that as well.
Well, you're on the CC list on that email, so don't you worry about that. And for other emails too. But all emails aside, look, everyone, it's been a fantastic episode. And again, so great to have Sylvia on board with us, part of Great People TV. She adds a lot of color, a lot of flavor, a lot of substance. She looks like $1 million and she brings great contacts like Nabil. So Sylvia, until the next episode, you stay safe. And
you too.
On behalf of Sylvia, myself, Ben Ibrahim, and everybody here at Great People TV, take care, stay safe, everyone, and we'll catch you on the next episode. Be well.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everyone.